open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
And we are back for episode 2 of Talking Twilight Zone with the authorities, Kitty, Bobby, and Ken. To kick the program off, here's our host, Bobby Neer. Good evening, Bob.
Thank you, Dan. Good evening to you. Well, today is only the second program, as you mentioned, for Talking Twilight Zone, but actually the first dealing with actual reviews. On our last program, we did an overall view of the series. Now it's time to get serious and specific with reviews of all 156 episodes. If you would like to call in and be a part of this live program, we would love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 1-800-407-5728. We only ask that you wait until the midpoint break in the show before calling, about 15 minutes or so normally. By that time, we will have given our initial thoughts. Okay, all of that being said, and before the series actually turns 50 on October 2nd, and especially before I turn 50, let us begin at the only logical place, episode 1. Here is Kitty with some emails we didn't get to on our first show, and then her summary and review of episode number 1, Where is Everybody? Kitty?
Okay, well, the first email we have is from Lynn in Norristown, Pennsylvania. She says, I was born the year Twilight Zone first aired, which was 1959. My brother was 6 at the time and was already watching the shows because he was and still is a sci-fi fanatic. The only reason I remember watching and actually understanding as much as possible was the final season in 1964 when I was 5. I was glued to the TV when Zone came on, and even at 5, I pretty much understood what they were about. I was always a smart kid and understood more than most kids my age. It's special to me because it was so different from any other series of its time. Over the years, I saw many, many reruns of the show and have watched every marathon every year. I also own the whole series on DVD. I will never get tired of watching The Twilight Zone. I have probably watched many episodes over 100 times and love the series. It will always be a classic to me, and Rod Serling was a master at his craft. And she says at the end, I always thought Rod Serling was also kind of sexy. He left us too early. And from Phil in Ontario, Canada, he says, I remember The Twilight Zone when it was first broadcast in 1959. However, there being one television in our home, and my parents had parental control, I was only able to view the odd episode during summer reruns. I also recall another Rod Serling anthology, Night Gallery. I am certain, let's see. Oh, and he says, back to Twilight Zone. I am always grateful to you, Bob, for providing me the opportunity to obtain the first season episodes. They've been a delight to watch. From Albert in Birmingham, Alabama. One thing that I've come to learn over the years, you don't discover the Twilight Zone. It discovers you, it engulfs you, and never, ever lets you go. I never saw every episode as a kid like I did with The Fugitive, but over time there were so many Twilight Zone episodes that I could relate it to my personal life over time. 2 years ago, I actually watched and recorded every Twilight Zone episode aired during one of the annual marathons on the Sci-Fi Channel, an event that has become somewhat of a tradition. The show itself, a part of TV history and American folklore, it is sometimes endearing, frightening, enlightening, confusing, always unforgettable. If ever a list of people who have made an indelible impression on TV history comes about, it would be a travesty if Rod Serling's name were left off of it. And thankfully, I don't think Rod Serling's name has been left off of it. But we have episode 1, the pilot episode that started the whole series called Where Is Everybody? That stars an actor by the name of Earl Holliman, who really has to basically carry this entire episode. We start out seeing a guy who's walking into a town. He seems to be just a guy out for a walk. And he arrives in town, and to his surprise, and to our surprise as well, nobody appears to be in the town. He goes into a diner to get something to eat. Nobody's there, and yet things seem to be cooking on the stove. He's able to pour himself some coffee. He makes his way over to a drugstore. He eats ice cream there, and there's nobody working there, but it seems a fully functional drugstore. He also notices a very interesting book title that is there called The Last Man on Earth, rather telling of this story. At one point, he thinks he sees somebody in a car, and when he gets over to the car, he realizes the person is nothing more than a mannequin. And so he starts to panic. He runs back over to a phone booth, and he attempts to call the operator, but all he's getting is a recording. And it all comes to a head where he just starts screaming for somebody to help him, and we find out that he really wasn't in a town after all, that he was simply in a room. They were running a simulation on him to see how long a person could be by themselves without going a little crazy. We find out he's an astronaut who's in training for a mission to the moon. And it has a very poignant ending to it, because at the very end, he looks up at the moon as they're wheeling him out, and he says to the moon, "Just stay right where you are, because we're coming." And I like this episode. In fact, if you know, and obviously Rod Serling did some research on this before he wrote it. If you look back on how they were training astronauts, the Mercury astronaut program was just in its infancy at that point in time. Nobody had even been sent into space at that point, at least not in the U.S. And if you watch the movie The Right Stuff, you will see that being put in an isolation chamber to see how well you did just being by yourself for long periods of time, that was actually a simulation they really were doing at NASA. So this was, I think this was well done, and the poignant part about it is that when I look at this all these years later and I realize this was filmed in 1959, was anybody who was watching it in 1959, did they really think that just 10 short years later we would actually be on the moon? And that, to me, is what just brings it home, because Rod Serling was such a visionary. You know, he actually did believe that we would one day get to the moon, and it's reflected in this episode. And I gave the episode a 5 for a classic.
No kidding, I didn't get a chance.
I think the episode delivers on pretty much everything.
I didn't get a chance to check on the internet before the show began today, but when did the early NASA program begin? It was in the late 50s or the early 60s? I think it was late 50s, wasn't it?
It was the late 50s. It started with Eisenhower.
I see, okay.
Yeah, Eisenhower was the one. In fact, one of the funniest parts about, if you watch the movie The Right Stuff, is that they're talking to then President Eisenhower, and they are doing suggestions on who might be appropriate candidates for going into space, and they were like talking about trapeze artists and stuff like that, and Eisenhower basically told them all they were nuts, and he said, "You get me test pilots for this."
Okay.
And so then that's when you started seeing them recruiting test pilots. But yeah, it was when Eisenhower was still president that they started doing the recruiting for that.
All right, let's let Ken check in here before we get to the break, and I'll do mine a little later. Ken?
Thanks, guys. Yes, I gave it also a 5 classic rating, and 2 reasons. First reason is that it's a good pilot episode to start the first season and to draw in your audience. And Rod Serling was a genius because the key to any television program is to draw in your audience. And that first scene where, you know, Mike, he walks on that lonely, dusty, dirty road, and he comes into town, and right away, you know, if you're watching, and I've seen this episode maybe 10 times, and every time I'm not bored. Right away, you just engage yourself with the character. All right, what's he doing? He walks into the coffee shop, walks into the church, you know, walks around town, but nobody there. And right away, the theme of loneliness just has to strike everybody because nobody really wants to be alone. In fact, I remember reading the book Robinson Crusoe on the Lonely Deserted Island, and that really struck me. And right away, you think to yourself, what if I was lonely, you know, in a town like this? What would I do? And especially the way the whole episode played out, you know, the unexpected, you know, he goes around the corner, what will happen? And you're with him as he goes around, what's going to happen? And that's the key to the whole episode, is to engage the viewing audience. The ending part was a little let down, you know, because you find out he's really not in that town. All along you think he is, but he's not. He's in the simulation, and it's just a test. But it was a good episode to start, and that's what you need. The pilot episode needs to be one of your best stories. You can't start off flat. And like a dud. I remember the series, The Time Tunnel. It was back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they just started right off with the Titanic. They just went for broke.
Right.
And that's what you have to do with your new series. Go for the best.
So do you think that this opening episode, of course, nobody had ever heard of The Twilight Zone. It was brand new. We look at it from a different perspective today. But looking at that first episode, they give you some idea of what it's going to be like in the future should it succeed. Is it going to be science fiction? Is it going to be the occult? Is it going to be superstition? Is it going to be a little bit of everything or what?
I always got the impression it was like a little bit of everything. I mean, when I was watching it, I never really thought of it as a science fiction show. But, you know, apparently it is classified as science fiction.
Yeah, I think that often, you know, but TV series begin, you can't always go by a pilot episode, because sometimes they'll do a pilot, and then you get engaged, as Ken said, in what's going on, so you decide to watch the series. And two, three, or four episodes of the series, you go, what is going on here? This isn't anything like I thought I was signing on for. But I think with The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling had in his own mind what it was going to be, and he controlled the strings on the show, and so that's why it stayed consistent. Now, I'm really, really glad that Ken mentioned about the ending, because I'll get to that in the second half of our show. Right now, I believe it's time for a break, and then we'll be back. Dan?
We will indeed, Bob. Stay tuned for part two of Talking Twilight Zone on Sharavision Radio.
Ben McCrae, and you're who?
Johnny Mann.
And Johnny is joining me again as my guest next Tuesday when we talk about his new wonderful CD, One Nation Under God, and we talk about some lovely tributes that have been presented to him this past year. And
thank you for coming back to talk with me.
Oh, don't be silly. I'm honored. I'm very honored, and I'm flattered, of course, Susan, because you are such a classy lady, and you run such a classy broadcast, and for you to have me back with you is a real honor.
And it's an honor for me to have Johnny Mann back so that we can get to know him again and find out what he's been up to. Tuesday evening, 6:30 p.m. Pacific, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, right here on KSAV.org. Your Sharavision Radio Network. We are in the air everywhere.
Part two of Talk. Talking Twilight Zone. Here's Bobby Neer.
Thank you, Dan. An elderly salesman who works off the sidewalks crosses paths with a cute little girl, while a strange man with the not-so-cute name of Mr. Death impatiently watches and waits from the sidelines. Comic actor Ed Wynn guest stars in episode number 2 of The Twilight Zone, One for the Angels, 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Twilight Zone. As I said a minute ago, I was glad that Ken mentioned the ending being a little bit of a letdown, because in my initial review on our board, I did not give this episode a 5, and then when it came time to vote, I actually cut it back to 4. Now I'm wavering, and I don't know whether I want to go back in and give it a 5 again, because it's hard to argue with the way it looks. I mean, it's creepy and scary, and it gives you everything you would hope for. But I will tell you this, The Twilight Zone is known for trick and twist endings, at least it would be in future years after this. But this is, I found the ending here just a little bit mundane. I mean, you watch this guy wandering around town, you're thinking all kinds of things. Are there space aliens? Has he been taken to another planet? Has he died and he doesn't realize it? What is going on here? And then you get to the end of it, and you find out, ha-ha, the joke's on you. He's just a potential astronaut, and they're just testing him to see whether he can go 20 days in a row without another person being around and not go crazy. From a scientific point of view, that's kind of interesting to think that they would have to find it out. But from a dramatic standpoint, I think it's a little bit of a letdown. Now, the other letdown for me is all of this explanation at the end. After we see him out in the street pushing that traffic button, and we find out that it's all in his mind anyway, then we get this long explanation from, I guess, the general or whatever, telling the reporters exactly what this is all about. And I think that undercuts it somewhat, to some degree. Now, I'll have more to say about that in a minute, but I hear that we have a caller on the line. So, Dan, put that person through.
Okay, there you go, Bob.
Hello, who's there?
Hi, it's Lynn Carpenter.
Oh, Lynn, the famous Lynn Carpenter. Lynn is a member of our group, an original member. You did, Sean, sign up originally, right? I think you did. And she's very enthusiastic about The Twilight Zone. She posts more than anybody, and we're delighted that you called into the show tonight. So why don't you give us your view about this particular episode and whether you liked it or not?
Well, I think this episode was perfect for the first zone. It's a little strange and creepy. The scene where he's in the restaurant and the coffee pot is boiling, and the scene when he's in the police station and sees a cigar burning in the ashtray are so bizarre. But who made the coffee? Who smoked the cigar? We only find out at the end that it was a simulated existence and in an isolated room with no possibility of him meeting a real person. Possibly a cruel test of a man's endurance, but possibly necessary for what lies ahead in the future for him, going to the moon. A test, well, yeah, but a very disturbing test, but it was an excellent episode, and it was perfect for the first pilot zone.
Now, of course, they didn't know that at the time, because, as Kitty just mentioned, it's very early in the space program. But do you think that it was a little bit overdone to worry about whether an astronaut would go crazy being alone for any amount of time? Because the truth of the matter is that anybody who goes up in space is so busy and has mission control jabbering in their ear all the time, then I don't think they would have time to go crazy, don't you think?
Yes, but yeah, I think anyone would be alone.
For that long of a time, and he didn't even know where he was. I mean, he didn't even know where he was. He was in a town, but he was not really in the town. He was in an isolated room. So I think that it was very disturbing to a point, but he had to do this to I don't know. I'm trying to say that he's trying. They had to do this to make him prepared for what he was going to deal with when he got up to the moon.
What about the ending to this episode? No letdown for you? You were happy with the way it turned out?
Well, I was in a way. Yes, I was in a way because I think he realized that he knew what was happening to him, and he knew what had happened to him. And when he looked up at the moon and said, "Don't worry, stay there. We're going to be there soon, you know, or I'm going to be there soon." He knew. He knew that he had completed his task. He made it through, and now he was going to be able to survive on the moon alone.
Yeah, but you know, he recovered kind of quickly at the end there. He just, looked up at the moon and said, we'll be back. So I was a little surprised that he didn't have any residual mental disability, having been...
No, he had no mental disability. They put that on him. They put that on him. They drove him to insanity almost.
Yeah, but if you just did that to me for 20 days in a row, and I believe that's what it was, I'm not sure I could talk coherently so quickly after that. So, all right, Kitty, Ken, anything you want to say to Lynn?
Well, one thing I wanted to add, Bob, was that final line by Earl Holloman, where he says, I can't remember the exact words.
He said, stay where you are because we're coming.
Right. That was the key to the whole episode, I think, in Rod Serling's book.
Right, right.
Whereas Moon,
exactly.
We're coming. And, you know, in 1959, everybody watching is going to say, we're coming. You know what? I hope we are coming.
But,
all right,
but
well, while there's still time, Lynn, do you want to stay on or do you want to go or what?
No. I just wanted to say one last thing. He said, we're coming, but actually, he's going to be up there alone. That was the whole point of the show, was he's going to be up there alone.
Yeah, but as things turned out, in reality, as we all know, we send teams of astronauts up now. Nobody's alone. As a matter of fact,
Absolutely. The
space shuttle just came back a couple of hours ago and landed safely. And there's a whole team on there. So, you know, as it turned out, nobody really needed to go up in space alone. And we certainly would never send a single astronaut into deep space should we ever have the ability to go there, where it takes a year or something to get anywhere.
But
that was all speculation. Looking at it now, it's 2009. In 1959,
right,
it was
but if
a different
you remember
story.
what his officer said to him, this time you will be alone. He said, you will be alone. Remember
all right. Well, then, thanks for calling in.
Okay.
All right. Don't be a stranger. Call in again.
I will.
Okay.
Thanks. You guys are great.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. Let me get, while there's still time here, let me get back to the ending and why I have some reservations about it. Aside from the fact that it's rather routine, given what's been happening here. Anytime you have a character come on, like I think James Gregory is the name of the actor who was on at the end there and telling reporters and everybody this is what we did, it takes, I didn't time it, it takes about 3, 4, 5 minutes. It kind of undercuts what comes before. In other words, I'm all hyped up and I'm nervous and I'm excited about what happened to this guy, and now it all calms down. I'm not saying that you don't need to do that, or that Serling had any choice but to do it, but anytime that happens in an episode of anything, and I've seen it many times, it serves to kind of undercut it. It just looks like, you know, like you're reading a book and you went back and read another chapter or something you missed. It's not quite the same.
Well, how would you end the episode?
Oh, I don't know. Now, I don't know if you're going to put that kind of pressure on me. I'm not Rod Serling. It's easy for me to sit here and say, so don't worry about it. Oh, sure, he could have just showed a couple of seconds and everybody would say, oh, I get it, so it's just an experiment. But I think the longer it runs, the more difficulty that you have. You know, earlier today I was reading in the Twilight Zone Companion, the book written by Mark Scott Zikri, that Rod Serling was initially very happy with this episode, but in later years he was not happy with it at all. And he actually, they put a book out with several of the episodes in it. In 75,
he took this story and he changed it. You might have read that in the book, Ken.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, and he changed it. The scene there where Earl Holliman goes into the movie theater, he just kind of barges in. But in the rewritten story that Sterling did, he gets a ticket even though there's nobody there. He tears it apart. He puts one in a little container. He keeps it in his pocket. And then when we get to the end of the episode and we find out what the truth is and they're wheeling him out, he finds the ticket in his pocket, which leads us to believe, what's going on here? Was it really an experiment or did it really happen? What do you think, Kitty? Maybe that would have been a more exciting ending.
Well, yeah, it certainly would have raised people's eyebrows more. Because it's like, okay, he had this, because it certainly would have brought up the idea that he had this delusion while he was in that room, but by the same token, he was also in that town.
Right, so there's really no, because a lot of future Twilight Zone episodes don't always end with a specific explanation. They kind of leave it up in the air for you to decide, what is it this, was it that, did I really see it, didn't I really see it? And so I think it's a little cut and dry, and I think Sterling saw early on that wasn't going to work after a while. If you do that with every story, and you just create these pat explanations at the end, then viewers will come to expect that, and they'll go, look, I can just sit here and watch this. They'll explain it all at the end, it's nothing, it's no big deal. So he changed the story. I found it very interesting. One other thing in the minute we have left or so, and that is we really need to give a lot of credit to Earl Holliman for a really great performance here. But I'm no actor. None of us are actors, but I've watched enough things over the years to know that actors play off of each other. It's extremely difficult to play off yourself. And this performance by Earl Holliman, as I think, is as good as the performance by Tom Hanks in Cast Away, where he spent most of the movie talking to himself and a volleyball. So in this case, he has to wander around and do it himself. What do you think, Ken? Pretty good performance, was it not?
Excellent. Good casting. That's the key to the series, too. You've got to have the right people playing the right parts. You know, just think of other character or, you know, other actors that maybe could have pulled it off. Maybe others wouldn't have. For example, let's say Rod Taylor or Telly Savalas or some of the guys around at that time.
I can see that,
Ed Nelson. Could they have pulled it off? I think Earl Holliman, he did just right. I wanted to also add, Bob, that the ending, the explanation, you know, by the general and all that, that did lower the episode. And I believe for the rest of the series, that doesn't happen again as far as explaining the episode away.
Okay, well, we'll have to discuss that later because we're just about out of time. So thanks to everybody. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Kitty. And thanks to Lynn for calling in. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with the second episode. We've got a long way to go. The Fugitive was 120 episodes. This is 156. So it's pretty daunting to look down that kind of time. But I think we've gotten off to a pretty good start, and it'll be interesting. It's easy this time because we all agree on this episode that it's a classic or a near classic. There's going to be other ones where we're not in agreement, and that will be on the next show that we do 2 weeks from tonight, One for the Angels. So this was, I think, an excellent start. Thanks very much, Dan, and thanks to everybody for listening.
Thank you, gang, and we'll see you in 2 weeks on ShareaVision Radio.